Dale. Yes. Der, hører dere meg nå? Jep. Ja. Sånn. Jep, da. Sånn. Yes, yes. Da var vi i gang, vet du. Jeg heter Jens Petter Sandvik. Jeg skal prate litt om, hva si, should I take it in English, maybe? Yeah, I'll do that. Almost forgot it here. I'm going to talk a little bit about digital forensics at the National Criminal Investigation Service, or as Norwegians know it as Kripos, where I have been, work as a senior engineer. And now I'm a PhD student here at Gjøvik also. So just going to have some introduction and then say a little bit about digital forensics and a little bit about my impressions about digital forensics in the police versus in the private industry. What the differences are and how it affects us in Kripos. So, I was conscient at informatics at UiO in 2005. That is the same as master, the old term, where I did my master thesis in evolvable hardware, genetic algorithms, was programming a bit VHDL, like hardware description language, and did some image processing. Then I was, while I was studying, I was also working as an antivirus software developer at a company called Norman. It was later bought by Blue Coat Systems and now by Symantec. At Norman I was working at the malware scanning engine, the Linux version of the engine, and also a bit reverse engineering of malware samples. And after I was finished with my master thesis or conscient thesis, I started at Kripos, where I started at the digital forensics section. There, I have been mainly doing computer forensics, network forensics, and also mobile and embedded forensics. My main focus there has been mobile and embedded, but. We started with not so many people, so we had to do a little bit of everything, but the focus was mobile and embedded. And now I'm doing more internet forensics and cloud forensics. Last year I started as a PhD candidate here at NTNU, and I'm writing about Internet of Things and which new challenges we will see with Internet of Things and when a huge amount of small devices are network attached. So that was about me. And Kripos, it's a part of the police. We have the police is split into the various police districts, and each police district should be able to handle cases, or they handle the cases that have typically been like where the crime or the suspect is in a geographical area. And they are also so that each district should be able to handle all types of cases, even cybercrime cases, and have their own digital forensics laboratories. They handle all types of cases: theft, white collar crime, murders, drug cases, cybercrime cases, and typically they have a huge volume of cases. They can't say no to a case, so they have to investigate all cases that come. So therefore, if a case seems to be very resource demanding and not very serious, then it might get less time than a case that is more serious so they have a huge volume of cases and they need to handle everything. Kripos, or the National Criminal Investigation Service, we are the national forensics lab. We don't do only digital forensics, we do all type of forensics like chemistry, tool markings, DNA, or actually it's Folkehelseinstituttet that does the actual laboratory work there, but all the samples get sent in to us and we give them further to Folkehelseinstituttet or National Health Institute. We also for the computer related cases or cyber related cases, we also do cases that doesn't belong to a particular district, either cases that spans several districts and don't belong home in one particular district, or cases that come from outside Norway, where the perpetrator sits in, for example, Romania, and are hacking things in Norway. And we do cases where it's needed special equipment or special competence. So in some cases, some of our equipment and the laboratory is really expensive, cost like maybe a million, maybe 2 million kroner. And of course, we can't say that each of the police districts should buy this expensive equipment that they maybe aren't able to use more than once a year. So therefore, like if it's needed like special equipment or the special competence that aren't needed on a daily basis in the districts, we can help with that. And then you have the Police Security Service. They handle cases that have to do with like national security, so everything. Everything of national security interest goes to them, so we don't see so much of those cases at Kripos. Then we have, it's important to know that the police also is like typically two tracks within the police. One is the policing and one is investigations. And I try to show it a little bit here. On the left side here, you have the investigation. It's a typically like detective work where some crime has happened, and the police is called, and we have to investigate what has happened and try to find out who did it, why was it done, what was the consequences and how was it done, why, all these questions that need to be answered and in order to like go to court with the case. On the right side here, we have the more policing part of it, and the policing part of it is more toward keeping law and order, stopping ongoing crimes, and prevention of crimes. This guy here is part of a campaign that Kripos was a part of. It's called the Police to Peer, and they flooded some child exploitation networks with these types of images and movies, where they gave them file names was typically a thing that seemed to indicate that this was some kind of illegal material. And when people downloaded it, it was downloaded from a police server, and they only got this picture up instead. And it says, "You have downloaded this file from a police computer, and due to the nature of peer-to-peer, depending on network, we now know your IP, username, list of shared files, and search terms. We may forward this to your local police anywhere in the world." And a link to a web page where you can read more about this campaign. And of course, this was a quite huge success, actually. We saw that these pictures, this is one of the pictures and part of the movies. Movies is the same guy standing and saying the same as is on this poster there. And many downloaded it, and we saw that actually in the places where it, in the forums where it was downloaded, it was also downloaded less afterwards from other material. So it seemed that it had a cooling effect on people sharing files. So in one way, it's like you can say that policing and investigations goes hands in hands. It's two different tracks, and it's two different laws that are used for this. With the policing, you have the police law, and with the investigation, you have crime. What's it called in English? Straffeprosessloven in Norwegian, or the crime process law, or criminal process law, I think it is in English. So it's like two different sets of laws, and the police handles both of those. So, of course, you can just ask me questions underway while I'm talking. We'll try to see if anyone has questions. So what do we do? I was talking a little bit about Kripos as a whole, but I work in one section that only does a small thing of everything Kripos does. And up until 2 years ago, I was in the digital forensics section, and that is the section I'm going to talk most about. We did all types of digital forensics. We do all types of digital forensics, and we started when I started in 2006. We were five people, and the focus was mostly toward computer forensics, how to like look at computers and find what evidence was on the computers. As the year passed, more and more focus went toward mobile and embedded focus, because we saw it was there more of the evidence that we could use in criminal cases was. Of course, it's still important with computers and all other type of forensic evidence, but we saw the focus was toward mobile and embedded. And now we see more and more increasing toward analysis of this data, because when I started, a huge hard disk was like maybe 4 gigabytes or 10 gigabytes. Now today, a common hard disk is 1 terabyte. So it's like you have this increasing amount of data that we have to go through, and it also means that we have to be better at analyzing the data that we have and pick out the important or the thing that has some evidential value. Not, we can't take everything and look at everything. We have to pick out the parts that that are relevant evidence in the case. Yeah, as I said, all forensics fields are still important. So it's not that we only do mobile forensics, even though we use a lot of money on it now. It's on equipment and such. It's still quite important with the ordinary computer forensics, and also it's like the ordinary computer forensics also is the common base that all other types stem from. So it's still important. We also are making tools for forensics. We do make both hardware and software for analyzing and acquiring, collecting evidence. We have our own hardware equipment for making not only electronics but also like physical tools and if we need some equipment to hold a hard disk in a certain position, then we can make that tool. So it's a traditional hardware making, and we do make where we see that the commercial tools aren't good enough. We make tools for scripts for analyzing ourselves. Wrong PC. The type of cases we do, I can say a little bit about this also. Like digital forensics, we often think about like the cyber crime and the cyber element in crimes, but actually most of what we do is murder cases, huge drug cases, organized crime cases. That is what we actually do most of. So it's like the contemporary crimes where computers, telephones, and other equipment have been used, cars. And of course, child exploitation cases is a huge part of it. I think most of the districts in Norway, they see a very huge pressure on these type of cases, because it is, at least the forensics labs, the digital forensics labs in the district see a huge pressure on these cases, because it is often many of them. And each of the cases has a lot of storage media. It's like not that we get one phone or one computer, but we get like maybe 5 computers and 50 hard disks and 50 memory sticks. So it's like and often much of this is encrypted, so we have to guess passwords and try to get into it. So those are quite resource demanding, and then you have the computer crime cases, cyber crime cases, where someone has like used computers for doing crimes or for like breaking into computers, breaking into companies' computers or other people's computers. We do also a lot of darknet investigations. We are finding it's been like the last years now. It's been a few cases where people that has sold and bought drugs on Tor marketplaces have been caught, and and we always look or also cases where we are child exploitation forums has been taken down on darknet. So it's but it's still many that that use darknet and thinks it's anonymous enough. So and then you have another type of crimes is labor market crimes. Those are usually very demanding because the people behind this are like white collar crime. We have Økokrim, that is our unit in the police for handling or like specifically handling economical crimes or financial crimes. But we have also been involved in those types of cases, and it's a huge amount of documents that has to be in, that we have to analyze. It's a huge amount of data. It's from several sources. Often it is like a few years ago we were investigating towards one of the grocery chains in Norway, and it was like hundreds of places we had been seizing material, both in grocery stores and at the involved people's homes. So it's so many places or so many scenes of crimes and so many storage media and a lot of documents that has to be reading through. Not everyone is relevant, but we have to skim through everyone to find out which one is relevant or not. And of course, it's a lot of other cases that I couldn't remember just in trying to make this slide. But it's all types of cases, and the typically cybercrime cases is just a small amount of those. So that's it. Right, PC is here. Yeah, and of course, a little bit about the tools we use. We do use a lot of commercial tools, of course, NKS, FTK, Cellebrite, X-Wave Forensics. In last years, it's been more and more companies providing or selling commercial tools meant for forensics, and the common theme among all these tools and all these programs and all these solutions is that they are not really good, any of them. But you have to find the one that is least bad on the things you try to do. so we often use NKS. In some cases, Cellebrite is a mobile forensics tool. Use quite a lot, but we also have a competitor XRY from MSAB that we also have used a bit, and X-Wave Forensics is another tool we use for going through hard disks, and we just have to select the tool that works for the job we want to do. And it's often not well documented what they are bad at. They are often very good at describing, we are perfect tool for this and this job and for this and this state. But it's only experience that where you can find out what they are bad at. So it's a little bit art in selecting the right tool for the job. And of course we use open source tools. SleuthKit, Autopsy, Bulk Extractor, Plaso. Has any one of you used those here in this course? No. Plaso is a quite good tool. It's creating timelines you go through the acquired files, and then it will pick out the timestamps and try to make a huge timeline out of everything. And of course you can define which time period you are interested in, etc. And Bulk Extractor is a really good program for carving data. And of course my own my personal thought is that that as the police we should use more energy in supporting open source tools than only use the commercial tools. But that is my personal belief, though. And of course, we use our own tools. We often have to create our own scripts, programs, frameworks, etc., for doing the things that the commercial and open source tools don't do yet. Often we see that it's like it's one small detail we need, and we should find, and nobody supports it, and we just do a quick and dirty implementation in Python or so. Other times we create our own frameworks for doing more the work with that is more specialized for what we do and not so much like we see that the other types of tools don't cover very well. And of course we also use tools from other law enforcement agencies and around the world and other like and we also give away our tools to other law enforcement agencies, and this is often within Europe or US especially. So it's within law enforcement we have a quite good technical cooperation between at least some countries. Not every country is on the same level when it comes to like the technical expertise. So not all countries create their own tools and such, but some do it. And of course one of the biggest countries that we are or the more advanced countries that we are cooperating with are of course the Netherlands and the Netherlands Forensic Institute. It's they are quite huge in all types of forensic sciences actually. Another big question is like, are we a laboratory or are we a part of a team? So are we the lab guy sitting on the office getting the PC in and we are checking the computer and giving the answer back to the investigator and say that, yep, here was the evidence, you got everything? Or are we the team here going on adventures and solving cases together? And of course, often police districts send, or also within Kripos, they send their devices to us. They will give us a computer and say, "Oh, find something interesting on this one. Can you see if it's something interesting here?" Or we get this computer together with a note that says, "Oh, I need all the deleted data." It's often like this, and then we have to try to figure out what they really mean, what they really are after. It is not a really good way to work. It will give some results, of course, when they tell me that, I think it is some pictures on this. Can you see if you find pictures of this and this? And yeah, of course, I can look for it. But the better way is to be a part of the investigation team. And the digital forensic section has worked quite hard within Kripos in order to become a part of the investigation teams. Because we can get in early in an investigation, we can give some advice with regard to how they should handle digital evidence or digital devices as they pop up in the case. We can help plan the investigation steps, and we know which or the probability of which data is where and how to get to it. So we can optimize the probability of finding the relevant evidence. And of course, when we know what the investigators are looking for, what their hypothesis is, then it's also easier to give suggestions about, yeah, maybe you should take this guy's phones, or maybe you should look at this computer here instead. And we also can prioritize, because a huge part of the digital forensic process today is actually the triage or the prioritization of which evidence to start looking at. Because when I started, we went out to a scene of crime and we grabbed everything and we went back to the office and started acquiring data, analyzing the data, etc. But now it's too much. We don't have time to go through everything. It takes a few hours to acquire a hard disk and a big hard disk, and of course those hours can be better used for something more relevant if we know it in before. So it's a lot of the work is to figure out like where the relevant data is and go to at those first. So I've been on cases where we where we found, I think it was 50 hard disks and about 50 thumb drives and a stack of CDs. And where should we start? We can, of course, just say, well, let's start at the one that seems to be newest. Well, yeah, of course, if the crime had happened a few years before, maybe it's not the newest where it lives, but we have to go a bit back and see which disks was in use at the time. Maybe not the oldest disks, but maybe not the newest, because they hadn't been produced yet, but some in the middle. And this triage is really important now. And we only can do that if we are apart in the beginning and also can say, give suggestions about how to acquire this data. And another thing, I didn't write it here, I will maybe come to it later, is of course encryption. When people have encrypted devices, how should we handle encrypted devices? Of course, the easiest way is to get the device while it's powered on and unencrypted. So that is also a part of the planning process. How do we get the PC or the while it is powered on and unencrypted? Of course, if you remember the Silk Road, first Silk Road case, where the dread pirate Roberts was sitting on a cafe and managing the Silk Road forum, and some FBI agents started to quarrel beside him and fight beside him, and he was like looking at the people that were fighting, and then the third FBI agent napped his computer while he was looking away. So and then they got everything unencrypted there. So that is one of the ways, and it can only be if the digital forensics guys haven't been involved in the planning, then these types of evidence acquisition isn't really possible. So a little bit about the trends I'm seeing. It's like, this is my personal opinion. I didn't really check out all the numbers here, but my impression is that we see more and more data stored with cloud services. And of course, this is the impression I have because I work at Kripos and it's the cases that get sent to us. So if this is true for, if you ask, for example, Oslo police, they will probably say it's another trend, but at least the trend we see at our lab is that more data is stored in cloud services. Like, you have Facebook data. People use Facebook a lot these days and chat on Facebook Messenger and use it a lot. You have Gmail. People don't use email clients, or many people don't use email clients on their own PC and download the email to their PC anymore. They just go to the web page of Gmail and use the online service there. We see more cloud storage, and we see also a lot of everything as a service. It's like you have storage as a service, you have network as a service, you have everything as a service today. And this trend pushes everything towards more cloud solutions. And cloud solutions also have their own challenges. It's easy reconfigurable, and that is one of the selling points, that it's with a cloud solution, it's easy scalable, you can reconfigure it on the fly, etc. And it also makes the data more volatile. It's like how the network was set up, or how the cloud service is or the storage is managed. It can be different today than it was yesterday. And of course, data can be moved in the cloud. And we see that in for example, cases where that has been in the news lately, that like American law enforcement want to have access to some email of a guy that is under investigation in US, and Microsoft says, "Oh no, sorry, you can't have his email because we know he's here in US and all this, but his data is in Ireland, so we don't have access, or we have access to it, but it's not under American jurisdiction." So data can move around in the world, and exactly who is the jurisdiction, but because American courts, of course, they will argue that, well, Microsoft is an American company with an American office, and therefore the data available to the American office also have to be handed out to American authorities. So it's not a very clear cut where data is. Can for example a white collar criminal say that, "Oh, sorry, my accounting, you can't get it because I know I'm an American company, but my accounting books are in Canada, so sorry, you can't see my accounting." Is that that is like the discussion that is going now. So it's not so black or white, but it's like interesting to follow. Another thing we see is more encryption used on devices, especially. People are still a little bit lazy, so if they have to, or if you have to do some steps to use encryption, people tend to not use it. But if it's a default, then it is used. So, for example, 2 years ago, hardly any phones came with default encryption. Today, almost everyone does. We have, like on Monday, I was talking about chip-off methods, and of course these don't reveal so much now as they did earlier. When we do the chip-off, read the memory directly from the flash, we only see the encrypted data, and the encryption key is in the processor or in the system on chip on the device. So we have to have it attached to the device in order to get unencrypted data. So that means we must update our methods, and this is a continuing work. It's like we find one method to do it, and suddenly the companies start to do things another way, and we have to update our methods. So this is something we see, and we have to take into account. And for some devices we have new methods, for some devices we don't, and etc. And of course we see smaller devices and more devices. Now people often wear clocks that includes storage that can record what they are doing, and And of course, it might be interesting to know that people had a very high pulse when we believed that they were running away from a scene of crime, for example. also, we see that it's a trend toward that the mobile phones are the new computer. People use the mobile phones instead of their computers today. They don't use the we see more and more people don't use chat on the computer. They use chat like an app, messenger app on the phone instead. So it's more data on the phones that is on the computers. Of course, a lot can be said about cryptocurrencies. Last 2 years, we have seen a peak in the use of cryptocurrencies, bitcoins, etc. That is not necessarily something bad, because when people use Bitcoin to buy drugs, for example, and sell drugs, we have a really good accounting of their business when they get caught. So it's like they have, so we see that all their income, all their profit, all their transactions, we see in the blockchain. So it makes it, in one way, a little bit easier for us, even though they try to anonymize it, use mixers, use various way of trying to anonymize their cash flow. It's still if we get their wallet, we still can see all the transactions they have done and the money going in and out of this wallet. And of course, it's been an increasing trend with anonymization services. People are aware, just like people are aware, if you're going to rob a bank, you have to wear gloves. They are more aware that if you're going to do some online crimes, you have to use some anonymization service, either through that you are taking using Tor, for example, but many places block Tor traffic, so it's not necessarily, and the Tor traffic also stands quite out on the traffic flow, or when you do when on the web server logs, you can easily see that it's traffic from Tor coming. So many services are blocking it, and it's easy to spot in the network that people on the network are using Tor. Then you have VPNs. People can pay for VPNs or use free VPNs. People can pay for botnets and use botnets as proxies to proxy the traffic. So it's it's many ways to try to anonymize where you are. So this is also a trend, and especially with the black market marketplaces, that is also a special case where much of the drug traffic and weapon traffic is going through hidden services on Tor, hidden marketplaces. Let's see here. Yeah. The last slide about trends is that we see that many crimes against Norwegian citizens and organizations originate from other countries. When you see the crimes against organizations in Norway, it's up to 90% of the crimes is unreported. I didn't check the latest numbers, but 90% is from 3-4 years ago, but I don't think it has been changing. It has been steady at about 90% for a long, long time. So that means that companies, when they see something bad is happening, they are blocking the access or they are blocking the attempt, and then they don't report it. And why they don't report it? It can be many reasons. One is that they don't want to use extra resources on it, because to file a complaint with the police, it costs a lot of resources. It takes you time to write file a report and to collect evidence, and then police will come and ask a lot of questions, and they will use a lot of time on this, and if they don't see that the perpetrators getting caught anyway, it might feel a little bit like why should we do it? And of course, even though many crimes stems from outside Norway, it's still many that are done in a proximity, either the social proximity or geographical. You still have like people like one company trying to steal the secrets of a competitor. It's like close by or people breaking into other other like friends' computers. So much of this is still happening in either geographical or social proximity. And of course, social engineering is still a huge factor. We have this even though we can think about all the security and security vulnerabilities and all this, the way people come into other people's network is often by social manipulation, social engineering. So one of the examples there is the CEO frauds that has been quite a lot of lately. It's like you get, it's like especially during vacation times and like this, then the secretary or like the secretary that doesn't originally have the work, but it's the summer intern or so, gets a phone from or an email from someone she thinks is the boss, that is seeming to be the boss, have a similar email address or like this, that says, oh, we need to transfer 1 million kroner to this bank account, it has to be done today, it's really important, otherwise our the contract we has been working in and in like several months now will be away, so we lose a lot of money if you don't do this. And of course, the summer intern that don't really know this, don't know how the boss is supposed to write and all this, she will think that this is something she has to do really quick and transfer money and send it through or tell someone else that, oh, we need to transfer this money. And of course, if you get someone intern in the company to say that, oh, we need to transfer this kind of money, I got a message from the boss and all this, then it's of course easy to feel a little bit stressed about the situation and actually transfer the money without even though you feel it seems a little bit strange, but of course I have to act really quick, so it's easy to say that, oh, it would never happen to me, but it does actually. It's easy to do this mistake, especially when you're stressed and have a little bit like adrenaline and you haven't been into this situation before and don't really know how to act. Many companies has lost money on this CEO frauds. So, I don't know, should we have like a little break now, or do you want to sit here for a longer time? yeah, we can. I can just go on. If you're not too tired. So, let's see. And of course, see you in court. Much of our work at Kripos is to be in court. That is the end of our work is to testify in court and to say what we have found and why we have found what we do, etc. It's like an oral exam covering all we have done in the case, and it's actually from my time at the university. When I compare it to the level of stress I have before I'm going to court, it's about the same actually. So it's It's like to have this exam where everything you have done will be picked on, and you have to have been doing a really good job and trust your findings. One of the challenges is that, of course, you are trying to use a non-technical language, because the people in the court, they don't know any technical language. They don't necessarily know what a computer is, and you have to describe what you do and how you have done it using a not very technical language. You have to use a lot of analogies and try to one thing is you have to say what you have found and be as exact as you can. On the other hand, you have to use a lot of analogies and of course the technical language is there because it's a very exact language. Everyone knows what it means when you use a technical language, but when you try to use analogies, all analogies will break down somewhere where they don't fit reality anymore. So you have to use analogies that fits what you're trying to say and don't drag them further than that. And you have to show, of course, if you use a technical term, you have to describe it and make sure that they understand what it actually means. You have to show the reasoning behind all the conclusions you have done, and the strength to your conclusion. You can say that, oh, this looks like this and this. I can't be certain about it, but maybe in area like 80% certain that this has happened, or you can say that, oh yeah, this is it can have happened, or it can't have happened. I can't say anything about it, or you can say that, oh, this has definitely not happened. So it's like you have to give the strength to the conclusions you draw, and you have to know that it's three parts in the court. It's three parties. It should be three parties in the court. You have the prosecutor. He know everything about the investigation that has been done, and he know everything about the evidence, because in Norway you have this integrated prosecution in the investigation. That is in many countries. Police are doing an investigation, then they are handing it over all the casework and all the evidence to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor is going through what the police have done and then going to court with it. In Norway we have this integrated in the police, so it's like you have the lawyer that is the prosecutor. He will often be a part of the investigation, or be very close to the investigation and give advice underway and say that, oh, you need to investigate this and this more, or you need to do this and this better. So of course the prosecutor will know all about the evidence. He will have his hypothesis about what has happened and know about all the evidence and know what you have found. The defense is another thing. They are going to defend the suspect, of course, and they want to find weak spots in the prosecutor's theory, the prosecutor's hypothesis about what had happened. They will try to find weak spot in the chain of evidence or the reasoning behind the evidence that is laying there. So of course that will affect us as digital forensics guys also. If we have done a bad job, then the defense often will pick up on that and say that, oh, we can't believe this evidence because they did a bad job at this. So we have to be really good. We have to have a really strong basis for our conclusions. And of course, it is the third part is the administrator or the judges. Their job is to get a best possible overview over what has actually happened. They will listen to the prosecutor, what he has to say. They will listen to the defense, what he has to say, and trying to make a most balanced conclusion based on these two parties. One of the tips I can give you for presenting in court is to draw a border between what is your factual findings, what is the facts in the case. You can say that this timestamp, it has been updated on this and this time, this timestamps, it says this and this, and what is your interpretation of this. You can say that the file created timestamp, it is usually set when the file is created in this file system, so therefore my interpretation is that this file has been created at this time. Of course, you can always argue that timestamp can have been changed later and all this, but as it seems, seems to be that this timestamp has been, or this file has been created in this file system at that time, at that particular time. And of course, you can last, you have to draw the border against this is your interpretation of what the finding means. You can say that we see that the suspect created this file at this point in time. Of course, that is a much weaker conclusion that the file was updated. So you have to be certain that you can argue that it was actually the guy that made this file, because it might have been someone else. So it's like, and if you are very clear about which type of where you are here, then it makes it much easier, because defense will often say that so they will try to give you, make you get some or try to interpret something and make you like, well, do you think this or this? And if you're a little bit uncertain, they will use that as a clue for saying that so you're uncertain on the facts also. But of course, that isn't true. So if you seem to be uncertain about one part, it might drag on to the other. But if you are drawing this border between these things, then it's easier to say, yeah, I'm uncertain about that. This is the guy that was sitting behind the keyboard, but I'm certain that the timestamp says this and this. So it's like it's a very good to like where are your uncertainties. So it's like where are your interpretations and your interpretation of the meaning and where is the facts in the case. This is something that I've experienced several times in court, so it's like it's keep that in mind. And of course, what we are doing often will affect, or we often are in an unknown environment, and it might have some risks toward health and safety for us. So devices might have been places you don't really want to know where they have been. We have get data out of telephones that has been inside someone, and of course it's better not to just use your fingers when you handle the phone, and use gloves this lab equipment. And of course, blood, other bodily fluids, chemical and drugs might be a huge risk. One example, I think that was last year or 2 years ago, last year maybe. It was a 15-year-old kid that died while at home. He was handling the drug carfentanil that was bought on the internet. This was in the news. I think it was about 1 year ago. So he had bought this on the dark market. He was handling it. A few micrograms of this drug is lethal. It's used for narcosis of big mammals like elephants. It was 10,000 more potent than heroin. So it's just a little grain of it is Lidl. And he had used gloves, but he still managed to get some of it on his skin, either through the gloves or on a bare area, and he just died. So it's like it's very important to take such things serious. It's it might be small traces of this drug on the phone afterwards, so you have to be really careful handling this. And of course, all things like sharp edges, broken glass, and when you're out on a scene of crime, it's a lot of other environmental risks there also. You shouldn't. It's like it takes longer time to acquire data and analyze data from a disc when you're at hospital than if you're on the lab. So it's important to take this into account. Other things is that it's hard to unsee things. What have been seen can't be unseen, as it's called. We see or hear things that might be hard to forget, and the psychological risk are also important to take into account. And I can just say from my own experience, one of my first cases at Kripos, it was a question whether I could clean some noise from a audio recording from this in Norway when people feel threatened, they can get this violence alarm, voldsalarm, as it's called. It's actually basically a phone with a GPS. So when you press the alarm button, it will connect to the police and it will transfer the GPS coordinates, so the police know where the phone is and they can listen in on what is going on. And in this case, it was a girl that had this violence alarm, and she was really afraid of her ex-husband, and he had gone to her place, and when he was there, she had pushed the button on the phone and said, "Oh, I'm really afraid. I see my ex-husband here," and of course she can't put the phone on. It has to be. It is from the police side. You can cancel the call. So the phone was recording everything that happened after that point. And the guy came in and they were quarreling, and then he used a knife and murdered her, stabbed her with a knife. And of course he stabbed her several times, and you could really hear this everything that happened. And the pictures I made in my mind when listening to this recording was quite bad. so of course such things is hard to anticipate before you really get up into it. So it's like please consider things like this that might happen before it happens, and have a plan to handle it. Because like if you're here now and sitting here, and maybe some of you maybe will start in the police, with the forensics in the police. Some might start in a consultancy company or a huge company, and you will get, and you might suddenly see things that you really didn't want to see, like for example, as I mentioned earlier here, child exploitation cases is a lot of those. And even though you work in a commercial company and are just checking just investigating, for example, a financial crime in a company, suddenly it might pop up pictures that you really don't want to see. And to be just aware of that this might happen is be aware that it is handleable, and of course, if you have someone to talk to, it is good to at least give it a thought that it might happen, and give it a thought what would I do if something like this happens to me, because it's hard to think this when it first have happened. So Let's see here. Police versus private. It's same, same, but different. So what is the difference between working in the police and working in the private industry? Of course, I don't have experience from working with digital forensics in the private industry, but I have a, I know people that works there. And of course, and I have worked with the private sector and see from and see it from a police perspective. So please keep in mind this is from a police or a law enforcement perspective. So from our perspective, we can't specify how systems that we are investigator are set up. So we just have to come to a scene of crime and work with what is there. If it's a financial crime and this is at a company, we just have to use the data the company stores. We can't really do anything about it afterwards. We just have to take what is there. But we can get data from others by legal means, so we can go to third parties and get a court order to say that, oh, you have to hand us these data. So we can get often get more data from other places and third parties than a private investigator can. And of course, the priorities, how we prioritize our cases, is set by the director of public prosecutions and the head of police and other authorities. So it is like we have this set of type of cases that are our prioritizations that says that each year we get a like list that this year these cases are most important and these cases are quite important and these cases are not so important. So it's like so of course nobody says that these cases are unimportant. They will just put it lower on the list of really important cases. So we get this list of which cases we should use most resources and time on. From the private sector, if you are doing digital forensics there, you often can give suggestions and specify the systems yourself. You are the one that owns the system, so you decide which type of things should be logged, where it should be logged, how it should be logged, how long it should be logged, etc. So it's like you can in a huge you can specify the forensic readiness. You can say that, oh, we have to have this data, otherwise we can't investigate if something happens, and you can be proactive. The private sector don't have the same legal tools, but are often bound by legal agreements and private laws. So it's a different set of laws regarding what the digital forensic examiner can do or investigator can do in this case. And often you will see that priorities are set by economical reasons. It's like if this costs too much, then we don't do it. And if we lose too much, then we have to do it. So it's often a different, or the reasons behind the priorities are different. And I see that when I'm working together with people in the private industry during investigations, then sometimes we don't really understand each other's priorities. But well, it's like it's a good idea to try to work around it and be aware of why. It's like from my police perspective, I can think that the stupid private industry, they don't do this and this, but and they can think the same with me, that the stupid police don't prioritize our cases big enough. So it's so we have to be aware of these differences in priorities and legal obligations that we have. Let's see here. And of course, a few impressions that I have, like a few thoughts of my own that I see is that more. At least of the bigger companies have their own forensic staff now. like before when I started doing digital forensics, it was mostly the police that were doing it, nobody else. But now we see more and more, at least in Norway it was like this, but now we see more and more of the bigger companies have their own forensic staff. And often as a part of the incident response teams or the security teams. And more consultancy companies are also starting to hire forensic digital forensic personnel. And many of my ex-colleagues has quit in Kripos has started doing digital forensics in consultancy companies, and are hired in by companies when they are, or they are hired in by, as consultants by bigger companies or smaller for that case, when something has happened. And of course, many incidents are handled by the companies themselves without involving the police, and that is, like I said earlier, that 90% of the cases is unreported, and this is this is actually the same. It's the companies handle it themselves. They don't report to the police. Maybe they feel it will be take too much resources to report it, or maybe they just think that, oh well, this happens so often, so we just it's like if we should report this every time a breaking attempt happens, then we wouldn't do anything else than report. So it's like so they only report the most serious cases, or it might be that they are also afraid of like public knowledge about that something has happened, that when the police gets involved and suddenly it's in the news and their reputation goes down. So it's like it's many reasons why it might be like this, but I just can see that it is. So let's see now. Oh, I already come to the final thoughts. Oh yeah. It was a little bit faster than I thought this. My final thoughts on working in Kripos is that it's actually a quite meaningful job. I feel that I'm actually doing something useful for the society by solving criminal cases, because a criminal case is often, it has happened towards someone. It's someone that is suffering because of it, and in this way it's nice to know that it's, well, at least for the victims, I'm doing a difference. I have been at Kripos now for 11 years, and I'm still not tired of working there. So I'm quite happy with both the work environment and also the feeling it gives me. It is always something new to look at. It's like every case is different. It's always something new. I never do the same job twice, and it's always something old, because sometimes I almost feel like a forensic archaeologist. It's like old devices, old technology. It's technology I thought was dead 10 years ago suddenly pops up in a case. So it's like it's often it's often not the newest and coolest technology we're working with, but it's things that have existed for some years, and something it's sometimes it's quite many years. I think the oldest thing I have looked on is a database from, when was that? Start of the 1990s. Had to like we didn't have any software for reading this database format anymore, so we had to try to reverse engineer the database format, and of course we had to like be aware that what was the why was this and this way of storing data used in this year, what was the limiting factors when we tried this database existed, that gives you a clue about what type of technology they used. So just like a small example of this is like the I386 instruction set. Anyone is aware of this how this instruction set looks? It is like like the CISC architecture often has don't have a set length of their instruction. It's variable length instructions, and it makes it so that processors, I386 architecture processor, and also that the 64-bit architecture uses a lot of silicon just to try to interpret how long instructions are, because you can't just grab 1K of data and think that this is a set number of instructions. You might split as instruction into them. But of course, at the time this instruction set started, it was the speed of the memory that was a problem, and therefore it made sense to make the most used instruction shorter and the less used instructions longer, because then you get more instructions on the same same amount of time. So it's just like a type of Huffman encoding. So it's like and if you're aware of that, it makes sense why the instruction set looks like it does. And it's the same with reverse engineering all data formats also. If you have an idea about what the limiting factors were, it gives you an idea about how it is stored. So sometimes we see things that are difficult to handle, and for that it's like helps to focus on a professional job, not focus on what you see, but focus on what you are supposed to find instead. So so now I came to the question or comment section. Is it some questions about Kripos or police or forensic? How many times I go to court during a year? It varies. It's not more than once a month. I think the year I had most cases, it was about 8 cases, six or eight cases in a year, so every second month at most. And this year I had been to court 3 or 4 times already. So it varies a little bit between, but also at Kripos we are we have time to use on each case, so often we don't have so many cases ourselves, and we have used more time each case, so I can use 2 months on a case, and that also affects how many cases I actually do during a year. But I guess 3 and 8 times a year I've been to court. Not every case, but for some cases, or in Norway, in order to present something in court, you have to say it orally. It's like the principle of in court that everything that is testified in court should be testified orally. And of course, if I'm in court and I can go to court and every time present this, but often it is enough if no one is contesting the findings, then it is enough that the prosecutor reads up my statement, and then they call it or they say that it has been covered. But of course, if it is questions about my methods, if it is questions about the findings, and my interpretations, then I have to be in court to explain it. So in the cases where either it's only factual information that I have helped the police district getting access to data, for example, and the forensic investigator in the district themselves is doing the rest of the case, then it's often enough that they say that Kripos found this and this, and we interpret it like this and this. So it's So for most part, I don't need to go to court, but in some cases I have to. So. Yeah. Yeah, of course. It is many cases that are we don't really find the evidence we're looking for, or don't get access to the data we really need. Sometimes we just let the evidence be, and suddenly we get a new method, and then we can go back and see. And sometimes we just have to give up and say that, oh, now this is too difficult, or too. It's like it depends on the seriousness of the case, though. If it is like a case that is very very serious, it's like a murder case, for example, then we will use a lot more of resources and use a lot more of time. If it's like it's not so serious case, then we can't use as much resources on it. So then we just have to say, okay, we can't get this get the data out of this device, or we can't. So it depends on and sometimes we it's not a serious case, but we do the case just to develop a new method. For example, we see that, okay, now we see more and more of this type of devices, then we should have a method for this type of devices, and then maybe we take a case that isn't so serious, but we take it because it had a device like this in it. So it's about how much we can prioritize it, actually, how much resources we can use on it. So, but of course, we also are like. We have less cases than a district has, so therefore we can use more time on it, basically. And I think that we more often we get results than we don't get results. So. Oh, yeah, I'm a little bit uncertain about it for my own part. Right now I don't have any cases myself now, because I'm only... have a 25% position. So the 3-4 court cases I've been this year, it's been from my old cases. But it varies very much. Sometimes it's a few very big cases, and sometimes it's very many but very small cases. So it's very difficult to say. It depends on the type of case and how much data is in each case. So it's like... because one case can be one memory stick, or it can be 50 terabytes of data. So it's like it is very hard to actually say how many cases. And I don't have the statistics for the digital forensic section now, but I can't really say how much it is. But like for myself, I see that maybe. In average, well, hard to say, because it's been varying so much between the years. But 1 year I had like maybe one case a month, so 12 cases 1 year. And another case I had about 5 or 10 cases every month. So it's like it depends very. Yeah. And of course, we are. In Kripos, in the digital forensics section there, we also are a little bit lucky with regard to the work environment, because we can say no to cases. We can say that, oh, this case is a case that the district should be able to handle themselves, and we don't take cases from the districts if it's just because the district themselves don't it's like if they only have one person doing digital forensics and then they have too much cases, we don't like help the districts with these types of cases, because the police chief in the district should be able to it's his responsibility to scale the forensic section so it so they are able to handle the amount of cases they are have. And of course the district can't say that we don't take your complaint here. They have to take it and they have to investigate it. So there they have a lot of cases per person and they don't use so much time each case. So it was one behind you there also. Yeah, yeah. They are at least they are supposed to have it, and I think all districts have it now. Yeah. So and of course, when it started, it was police officers that had was interested in computers that did this. But now, in more and more, we see that it's civilians that that get hired to do the digital forensics work. It's like they hire people with like computer security background or they hire people with administration computer or like network administration skills and they get like taught how to do the forensics. So of course, like if you already have a forensic like background and idea, then it's like it's also a good thing. So it's I'm actually not sure now, but I think all districts have civilians working on the digital forensic sections. I think so. So yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a work in progress actually. It's like for police officers, they can have this forensics courses at the police college to get some idea about what this is about. But of course, that is not very deep understanding of computers. That is more like. this is a computer. This is how you use the tools, and to get out data and they are taught how to. The police college classes are for police officers that either are going out and working out at the scene of crime that wonders about, oh, we see a computer here. How do we handle it? The more advanced classes is for like police officers that want to work more on digital forensic cases. And then but for the civilians, we don't have really a set education. But we have like it exists many like commercial courses for that teaches you a little bit. And of course we have internal seminars and they can people from the districts can come to Kripos and work there together with us for like maybe a couple of weeks and we will teach them how to like at least take care of the like how to handle evidence and like this, because people that come to us often have the technical background. They know computers, they know know system architectures, they know have the technical background, but they lack the knowledge about how to handle evidence, what is important when you handle evidence, and how do you write a report that can be used in court, etc. So it's like they get more this training for us. And then of course we have like this internal newsletters and forums where we can discuss how to do things, and they can always call someone else if they are insecure about how to do this or this. So it's like it's no set education to become a forensic investigator in Norway in the police. So it is handled more it's like but of course the exam is in the court, so no matter how good the education you have, it's in the court that matters. So, any more questions or comments or nobody? Like, but just yeah, I wrote up a few addresses here. One is my email address at the police, and then I have the Facebook accounts, like Politiets Nett Patrulje Kripos. It's like a Facebook account that is like where police officers are yeah, they are like answering questions and giving some advice and all this. Many of the districts and offices have their own Facebook page on where they like try to get in contact with the local region, and of course you have the operation centrals that are on Twitter and tweeting about what is happening in a district, and also you have the main web page. Yeah, well, seems. Yeah, is it many that after this talk, is it many that want to work in the police? Here, it's well, it is probably not an area that will become less important in the years to come. So it's so I think also with the new districts, is the police has been reorganized, so we have fewer districts but bigger districts, and that means that it is a more centralization of the like special services, like so digital forensic labs often get more centralized now, so you get this bigger environment in each district. So, and they will probably I guess I can't promise anything, but my guess is that it will become more positions for like civilian digital forensic specialists also. So yeah. So I think if nobody has more questions, then it's it's just to, and of course if you see me around, so it's just to ask if it's something you wonder about. So yeah. So thank you for today, and thank you for listening.